Hello.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Neely. This is one in a series of special shows celebrating the 25th anniversary of Peach Pit Press. On the line with me and waiting to chat is Steve Krug, a highly respected usability consultant who makes the web a happier place for you. He's worked quietly for years with companies like Apple, Netscape, AOL, BarnesandNoble.com, Excited Home, and Circle.com, among I'm sure many others. He may be best known for one of my favorite books, Don't Make Me Think, A Common Sense Approach to Web Usability, now in its second edition with over 200,000 copies in print. And I'll tell you, if you know anybody in the usability space, they will recommend this book to you. The Don't Make Me Think is the product of more than 10 years' experience as a user advocate. And with that, I welcome Steve to the A-List. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Jennifer.
I'm so thrilled you could be here. You are like a rock star to me.
I almost wasn't here.
So tell us what happened.
I have this theory that people who do like usability for a living do it because they're easily confused and they get lost a lot. I mean, I keep meaning at the UPA annual conference to like do a survey about this, but I was like ready very early for this because I wanted to try out my headset and whatnot and make sure it was all working. And I went to the emails that I had from you, and I got confused. I saw the word Skype in it when I read through it when I first came in, and I thought, oh, okay, I'll just go through Skype. And then I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to do.
So. Well, I'm sorry about that. You got to make it as easy as possible, so I'll have to work on my usability.
No, it's me, not you. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I can do it well for a living is because I'm a great surrogate for users because I get confused easily. So.
Well, that's a great place to start because we wanted to, obviously we've got a lot of people excited about you being on the show, actually. We had a lot of hits to this page beforehand, more than usual.
That was probably me refreshing it, trying to find directions.
I bet it wasn't. Everybody always wants to know, what are clients struggling with these days? Is it the same thing they were asking 5 years ago? What is it in terms of usability that's sort of the hot item? And don't say mobile because I'll ask you about mobile in a little bit.
Yeah. I think there's a distinction between what they think they're struggling with and what they really should be struggling with. I mean,
you really are a consultant. That's true.
Yeah. No, I'm not sure why that's why I became a consultant, because I actually just wouldn't fit in holding a regular job. I always tell people I wouldn't survive more than a week holding a regular job. The two hot topics when you talk about usability and you have to do usability presentations at conferences and you look at the agendas nowadays, there's the two hot topics. There's mobile and there's social networking, right? And so the big questions are, okay, so what are the usability implications for mobile and what are the usability implications for social networking and what do we have to learn and what do we have to do differently? And quite honestly, I tend to not think it's particularly different. It's one of the reasons why I resisted doing really updating Don't Make Me Think for so many years was because I couldn't think of what to say that really had changed. And Jacob Nielsen, who I respect a lot, and he's a really smart guy. And I 20 years ago, I learned most of what I got started with in usability by reading Jacob Nielsen's book at the time. He has said quite eloquently, which I'll paraphrase, that technology changes very fast, but usability changes slowly because usability isn't about technology, it's about people. It's about what people get confused by and the problems people have figuring things out. So while there are some specific issues that, become more of an issue as the technology changes or as the kinds of tasks that people are doing change, as with something like social networking, for the most part, it's not that different. So you know, I think people still have the same usability problems that they've always had, which is that when you go and look at the thing, you can't figure out what it is. And that's the hardest one for people to fix, because by definition, if you're building it, you know exactly what it is, you know.
Right.
So it's very hard for you to stand back and put yourself in the mindset of somebody who doesn't know exactly what it is. So you don't feel like it's worth wasting their time and your time and the space to make it clear what it is. So even though a lot of stuff has changed, certainly, you know, in 15, well, what is it now, for 20 years, I guess, with the internet, that basic problem, I think, is still the one that I see most often.
That's really an interesting insight, because it's always, you know, we say in life a lot of times, or at least I do, it's the little things.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if one of those things has to do with, and it looks like do you specialize in sort of U.S. usability, and at conferences they talk about sort of international usability and the differences that may exist between the two?
When I do client work, it's, basically U.S. work, although I actually did just recently go to spend a week in Germany working on something that actually was in German.
Yeah.
For a week. If you want to be tired at the end of the day, try analyzing an interface that's being translated for you on the fly.
I'll be doing that next week in Iraq. So.
Oh, is that? That's where you're going, to Iraq.
Arab and in Kurdish. So that's It's very interesting, because with characters so different, and I am not, I don't recognize the characters quite yet. I'm trying to. So I go into translate and I'm like, oh, well, this, you know, might be a nice sentiment or might be a negative sentiment, and it's completely different than what I thought it was going to be. So it's going to be interesting to.
It's very interesting. I don't think I'm at liberty to say who I was working for, because I haven't worked that out yet. But they were very nice people, and they were very smart, and most of them spoke English better than I do. But there were a couple of people who were responsible for parts of the product who were working with, and they were reading me through the interface. And actually, I mean, their English was fabulous, but every once in a while we'd come into something, and I would realize that by the time we got to the bottom of the page, I couldn't remember whether the options at the top had been, you know, okay and cancel, or okay, continue and cancel, you know, whatever. And I couldn't just glance back up and see it. So I warn you about your trip, that it's a serious cognitive load. But where we got into that was, is the U.S. any different, or domestic? See, I don't do anything. That's one thing that I learned. I actually learned in high school how to keep track of where I was in a conversation. It was
very good.
It was a hard learned lesson, but I consider it one of the most valuable things I ever learned.
That's very good. No, I asked that because, I mean, obviously I specialize in global, so I'm working on global projects all of the time, and it's interesting because I find that, you know, for example, somebody years ago, I worked at a company that wanted to use the same framework for basically social network in a box for Brazil.
Right.
And the Brazilian specific markets in Brazil, and then wanted to do the same thing in mainland China.
Right.
And what we found was by, you know, being a geek and reading, you know, Jacob Nielsen's work, and especially with the eye tracking, which I love reading about, that people in mainland China inherently don't want to click, for whatever reason, they want to click on characters. They don't want to click on pictures. Whereas you can imagine Brazil, you know, you've got a sexy woman, a sexy guy, they're going to click on that. They don't care what it says. So,
And there you have cultural differences in a nutshell.
Right. You translate that to the web, right? And you start looking at, what's going to, you know, if can you create a framework that's inherently going to work, you know, from an architectural standpoint, from a technology, various technology standpoints, is it going to work in the way it was being implemented it wouldn't have? So that was one of the sad truths that I had to deliver. I'm wondering, you know, along the same lines in terms of struggle with social networking and mobile, certainly within this country, and generational marketing is another area that's sort of a passion of mine. You know, I wonder how much it's sort of generational versus psychological that gets people, and maybe it's a combination of both. I have a feeling it probably is. That is what is at the heart of helping people find things and make it easier for them.
Helping them find things. Well.
Well, you know, just in general usability. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
To go, this is the button that
I
should be pressing.
See, I tend to think it's the word human. You know, I think you're dealing with human beings, and if you took the differences, you know, what was his name? Seymour. Oh shoot, one of the big people in IA. I heard him talk over at a house at Harvard many years ago.
It'll come to you in a minute.
It will come to me in a minute. So rather than him and Hoff for a long time, I'll just continue. And somebody asked him if he was a genius. Now, he was this incredibly arrogant guy, so I was sort of waiting for the answer. And he said that if you take into account the fact that human beings learn to speak a language by the time they're a certain age, that if you all the other differences in intellect on top of that amount to, you know, like 3%. Like if you take the challenge of learning a language and then you say, okay, well then there was how much more Einstein knew. That was like maybe another 3% on top of the basic.
Mm.
And I thought that was brilliant. And I was also shocked because he was so arrogant that he was, he would say he was only 3% smarter than everybody else.
Maybe that's because we don't know his name, so we can just kind of figure it out.
Yeah, I will. And I kind of feel that way about usability. There are huge differences. You know, I look at my son who's in college and you know, people I know who are old enough that they haven't even learned to use computers yet because they're older. And I see the challenges that they have in terms of usability, and they all look kind of the same to me. You know, it all looks like the things that are really going to confuse a lot of people are probably going to confuse everybody else.
Mm.
And my big hobby horse these days is that almost anything that you look at has some serious things wrong with it in terms of usability. It's inevitable. I mean, they're designed by human beings. They're designed by human beings who can't get much distance from it because they know too much about it, and who are overworked and don't really have a lot of time to put into usability. And so they all have kind of serious problems. Unless you've done my other hobby horse, which is usability testing. If you've actually watched some people try and use the thing that you're building, then those worst problems will immediately become obvious to you. You know, it's not like, oh, we'll do some usability testing, we'll test a whole bunch of people, and maybe we'll find the most serious problems. If you watch a few people use the thing, the most serious problems are going to, and you've watched usability tests, it's not like the most serious problems are going to sort of, you know, most people watching them would notice these most serious problems. They hit you over the head. It's like everybody sitting there says, oh, of course, nobody's going to understand that. Why didn't we think of that? You know? So, and to me, those are the biggest problems that are out there and the ones that stay out there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because unless you do some testing and then put the time and effort into actually fixing the worst problems have a tendency to stay there. Because they may not be that simple to solve. They may actually take a fair amount of effort, and so people end up going for the low-hanging fruit instead.
Well, this kind of riffs off that idea. You know, it's really, the idea of, you know, sort of trends that come and go in web design or other pieces of the web that affect usability in a great way. Are there any recent trends that surprise or bother you?
We can move to mobile as an and you and I haven't discussed this beforehand. I feel like I should point out, because anytime I have like an interview, you know, nowadays, people always talk to you about the questions beforehand. You always know what they're going to ask. It's like being on a late night talk show or something, you know?
Well, this is the purity of CNN type reporting here
I'm impressed, and it's kind of pleasant change. I like the element of surprise. But I feel like a magician. I feel like I should say we actually have never met before, right? You can tell the guys we've never met before.
Well, they know from the users that I have know, because this is how I do the show. Only very, very specific people get questions ahead of time, and usually I disclose as much as I can. But you know, off the top of your head.
So mobile. All right. So mobile. See, I can keep track.
Trends and web events surprise or bother you, and you mentioned mobile first.
Well, mobile first in the sense that specifically the iPad, because I've been a tablet PC lover and user for like 10 years now, when they really were tablet PCs, when they were PCs running the Windows tablet PC software. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't touch them, and you had to use a pen. But I liked the pen. There were a lot of things you could do with a pen that you can't do with your finger. But I really like the iPad. I like the iPad a lot. I carry it with me constantly because it weighs almost nothing. It's really thin. It's like, you know, it's the size of the proverbial pad of paper, and the battery lasts all day. So
yeah,
what's not to like? I do email and I browse the web on it. And I have probably 150 apps that do other things, of which I use three. But what I don't like about the iPad, or what I think is a bad trend in terms of usability about the iPad, is that one of the reasons why I only use three out of the 150 apps is because everybody makes up the interface again as they go along. There's no interface standard. So it's kind of almost back to, I don't know, since we haven't met, I don't know how old you are, but you may not be old enough to remember the days of the introduction of word processing, when everybody all of a sudden could do their own typesetting. And everything looked like crap because nobody knew how to design. And it was all different and there were no standards. And it took like 5 years for it to kind of sift out to the point where people started to learn how to actually use the stuff. So now with the tablet PC, with the iPad, there's almost no interface standard once you get
past Apple. And Android is the same, so we should point that out. That Android.
Well, exactly, and I only don't point that out because the path I've been down is the iPad. My son and I have been arguing about whether I should actually leap to the Android.
Well, you should have both.
At least for my phone. Yeah, maybe.
I recommend the Samsung Galaxy.
Yeah.
That's one of the best.
No, wait, it's the Samsung Galaxy. Okay. Well, I wouldn't use more.
It's been in Singapore for like 2 years. I mean, they've been testing it in other markets as far as I know, the longest. So that's why I always say, if you're going to try one, that's the one I go with, just because they've had the most time.
I mean, I've tried them. I have friends who have them. I've played with them for a couple hours. So it's not the same as owning one, as using one. Day.
Yes, that's very true.
I'm trying to decide whether I should go to an Android phone So anyway, the thing is, with the Mac and the PC, there were system-wide standards like the menus. You knew there were menus there. Almost every app, except for the bizarre ones, had menus, and they had the same menus. And if you were looking for a particular kind of function, you knew probably which menu it was on. And you knew how the menus worked, and you knew the preferences were going to be in one of, like, two or three places. And now with all these apps that I have, it's like every time I go back to use an app that I haven't used for a while, I have to relearn it. I have to consult the help just to find out how to get to the settings in some cases, you know. Or how do I
That's
pop
annoying.
Up the menu? What corner of the screen do I have to tap on to pop up the menu? Or is it a two-finger tap? Or is it this little dot here down in the corner? Or whatever. And while it's not the worst problem in the world, I think it's kind of detrimental. I'm not a big fan. I have to say I'm not a big fan of consistency as a usability principle. But consistency at the level of at least being able to figure out in all the apps how you get to the command seems like a worthwhile. It's kind of like with Flash, where people used to create their own scroll bars, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So they look cool, but they didn't realize that actually the development of the scroll bar involved like a lot of evolution and a lot of work, and that scroll bars worked well because people had tinkered with them for a long time, and that's why they were all the same. So.
On the other hand,
Apple just flipped the scroll bar. You know that, right?
And actually what helped me the most, I talked with, we had another Peach Pit Press Anniversary Series interview yesterday. I talked to Robin Williams. Not the actor. But
As I would say, the Robin Williams. She's great.
She's fabulous.
She is great.
She explained to me, because I've just switched to line, and I said I can't quite, because I'm on, you know, I'll be traveling, I'll be on my MacBook Pro, and then I switch over to my big 27-inch, and I should be enjoying this big computer, but then get the mouse, and I'm off again on scrolling, and she said, they just made the scrolling like it is on the iPad,
right.
And suddenly it unlocked for me the secret to using it. I don't know why that phrase made it completely make sense for me.
Right.
You know, and I guess that's the beauty of usability is it can be, you know, something that just clicks in your head and it suddenly makes sense. But you're absolutely right. It felt backward. And
right.
I didn't want to change it because I want to move with the times and make sure I'm adjusting and, you know, force myself to do
right.
the thing, right?
Which is fine unless you're going back and forth between two different machines and one has the new stuff and the other one doesn't. Then you might want to change.
Both have Lion, but the thing is that one's a trackpad, which I find to be different, and then when you introduce the mouse, it's different.
Yeah.
So it's the same scrolling, it's the same everything, it's just that the mouse introduces a different element.
Right, because you're used to doing it one a different way with the mouse. Yeah.
Exactly, and with a trackpad, it made sense because it's like, that is more like an iPad screen. So
right, right. I'm pushing the piece of paper up.
It made more sense.
View window down, yeah.
Exactly. So I'm not doing perfect every time, but hey, you know, that's interesting. So we've got web trends that surprise you and bother you is the original question. Anything else you want to add to that?
No. You probably have more questions.
We've covered it off. That's great.
You probably have more questions, don't you?
Well, I have tons of questions. So I want to know about HTML5. So let's dig deeper into mobile. So you talked about apps. And we're in app land right now, and lots of people are asking me, as a social media management consultant and someone who's been through the .com and the .bus twice, you know, what do you recommend in terms of going with an HTML5-based app versus, you know, actually building out an app? It was interesting because I have an iPhone, so I used Google Plus for a few weeks as an HTML5 app, and the way that they did the interface didn't bother me a bit. It's totally fine. I still got the button on my desktop if I wanted it.
Right.
And yet people don't really realize that most apps are really just in a package. You know, they're still connected to the web for 9 times out of 10.
Right.
You know, if not more, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are about HTML5. There is also that sort of sub-discussion about, you know, whether real designers are designing if they're using HTML5 too. So if you have anything to say about that, feel free. Just the topic of HTML5 as a trend in apps. And what do you think, you know, what would you place your bets on if you were advising somebody over the next, let's say, 2 to 3 years, where HTML5 is going to go?
I'll fall back on my prior statements, which in the beginning of, in the introduction of Don't Make Me Think, so this was 10 years ago, although it was the introduction, so I was probably writing it last, so it was 9.5 years ago, whatever. I said that I'm no good at predicting trends. So we've strayed into two areas where I consider myself more or less useless as a source, which is trends and technology.
Well, here's the thing.
I keep up, although I'm still a little behind on HTML5. I think I need to take a half day workshop or something on HTML5, so I really understand. But I read about it, but I'm no good at predicting trends. So.
But in terms of your own experience as a usability expert, would you prefer to install the app if you had the choice like I did on Google Plus to just
right.
stick with the HTML5 app? It's got the button. I'm fine. I'm on the web. Or to move over and actually install the app, would you feel like you have, you know, would you just install the app? Is that what you would do, or would you put any thought into it, or just go with the flow?
Honestly, since, as I said, I've got like 150 or who knows how many, but I got a gazillion iPad apps. So I try iPad apps all the time, partly because it's this flow of new interface ideas. You know, it's very interesting to see what people are trying, and partly because there are a couple of apps that I would really like to have that would do certain things, and people keep writing versions of them, so I try all of them to see if any of them are any good. But I install, you know, for one thing, I think I'm partly like most people in that I might not necessarily be sure that I knew the difference. You know, I mean HTML5 is it's nice for us because we're talking inside baseball, but you know, and the app versus HTML5 has a lot of implications for the people who are developing them. But in terms of the people who are out there using them, you know, the early adopters know the difference, but do most people? I don't know, you know? In point of fact, as you were saying that, I was thinking, well, wait a minute, what am I using? Because I like Google Plus. I like Google Plus a lot, and I've been exploring it a lot, and so I installed. Did the Google Plus wait? The Google Plus app. When did the app really come out?
I think 2 weeks ago.
Really?
Something like that. Yeah.
Because I'm not even sure what I've been using. Because I have the icons. I have two icons.
Yeah.
I have two icons. One is to a bookmark for Google Plus.
And that's the HTML5 version.
And that's the HTML5. So I guess I do have the app. But I'm not 100% sure what the difference is. I guess I
think that's a great point, because you said that early on, you know, one of the things about usability is that maybe things aren't that easy for you to find. So this is a good area, because I think you are absolutely bang on. Most people don't know the difference, and there's huge implications monetarily for companies and scalability-wise and being able to be more agile in terms of changing the look and feel or colors or interface. I mean, once that app has been approved, goes into Apple Store, and God forbid you make changes, make another version, you got to get that approved, et cetera.
Right. That seems like a nightmare. And you know, cross-platform, I mean, we're talking about a big difference here.
So I think that's an interesting thing.
And on
thing
the other hand, presumably there are things that you can do in the app that you can't do in HTML5.
I've been looking, and I haven't found any. So
really?
That'll be interesting. Yeah, the thing that makes it a little bit easier, and this is one gripe I have with Google about Google Plus that I never hear anyone talk about. This is Web 2.0, 5 years ago, I want to say. And there were two British guys, brilliant guys, talking about usability. One of the things that they were really banging on about at the time was signing in and signing out of things, and how you really, in a lot of instances, and they gave very specific examples, where you're not really securing your data, it's giving you a false sense of security, or it's really interfering with the flow.
Right.
And for me, as a Google Apps user for multiple companies that I may work with and have email addresses or whatever, it's an absolute nightmare on my phone, because my phone may be, you know, especially if I'm using HTML5,
right,
it's just using the browser interface of Safari, right? So it's trying to sync everything to my own company's Google Apps account, or it can't figure out which one it is, which one's got the profile. So I might be signed out, and, you know, let's say, you know, I'm stopped at a street corner, I've got 2 seconds, somebody messaged me, and I want to just, you know, add them to a circle. Something
right.
like that could take me, you know, a good 5 or 10 minutes to figure out, you know, okay, I got to log out, log back in, you know, maybe, you know, that whole process, the logging out, the logging in, and the app's not, you know, if you have an apps account, it absolutely does not include Google Plus, I'm sure,
right.
because the business piece that they're going to be adding at some point. But that I find just, it's terrible usability. The sign in, sign out, and being state aware and all that, it really bothers me. That's one thing that I was surprised about. And I'm surprised more people don't talk about that, because it seems like signing in and signing out is one of the central things we all have to do.
Right.
And, you know, it's kind of like, again, duh, it's right in front of your face. You got to do it. So that was the difference for me with the HTML5 version. With the app, it's a little better at being state aware that it's signed into a particular account.
Right.
So that's my Google Plus account, and I don't really have to mess with it. And when you introduce the browser, it's a little bit different.
Right. But couldn't they actually potentially handle that part of it better through an iPhone app that was a wrapper for the HTML5?
Well, I mean, that's essentially what apps are, right?
Right.
Couldn't the app
take over the login component and handle it the way an app would?
Yes, that's what it's basically done. That's the real big difference for me, is that it is more state aware of my Google Plus account being a particular login than the HTML5 version. That's really the only difference that I see in terms of the way that I've been using it. So.
Right.
You know, for my, you know, I'm talking way too much. You're the expert.
No, 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 no. But
so
it comes back to the point. I mean, I'm always very impressed. I've always been very impressed with how, when you do a usability test, you know, usually the takeaway is something like, oh, my God, people actually don't understand whether they're logged into our system or not. You know, it's often at that level is what you discover, the things that
you're
appalled to find out that people – might not be aware of, and might not be aware that they're not aware of, you know.
It's doing like tech support to someone you love, you know.
Right.
You know, long distance tech support. I mean, honestly, yeah. You know, I was talking with someone for the longest time, and I had to even put my husband on the phone because I couldn't handle it anymore. I was getting really frustrated, and you know, I didn't want to start yelling, and so hand the phone to him, and he realizes that this person thought that their computer and their browser were the same thing.
Right, right.
So they've opened their computer.
Yep.
No, you've opened a browser. And this browser doesn't like you, so you need to open up Firefox or something anyway.
Exactly. It's not an uncommon perception, you know? It's
I'm
like,
sure.
It's like...
So I guess given all of this sort of side discussion, do you, as an expert in this area, whether by stumbling upon things yourself and trying to figure out your way, I love your book. I read it probably the version before it is now, and it's just, I love the name.
Yeah.
You have to tell us at some point whether you were part of that. But before we get there, do you think we're making progress in making the web more usable? Or is it bad as it ever was?
Oh no, it's a lot better. It's a lot better because it's a lot better, sort of for one reason, which is that unlike the software, when people were doing actual software usability, even more so, it's so easy to copy stuff on the web. You know, so the best practices have gotten adopted very quickly. You know.
Mm-hmm.
He comes up with a bright idea, somebody does a really nice implementation of something, and people, you know, not that they go in and grab the code, but they see how it works and they can use it themselves. So I think usability in general on the web has come a long way very fast. I mean, if you went back to the Wayback Machine and just picked some apps at random from, you know, 10 years ago. And I think you'd be kind of appalled, because I think we've forgotten how crummy a lot of stuff was.
So do you remember? Which is not to say that
a huge percentage of the stuff that's out there is riddled with major problems. You know, but I think the kind of mainstream stuff that has people working on it who have a fair amount of experience has gotten quite good. And the worst stuff isn't nearly as bad. I mean, you really used to run into, you know, it's like almost every site you went to, you couldn't figure out, you know, and I think that's not true anymore.
And
also, the stuff that they're doing on sites is far more sophisticated now. So if they're, you know, where you run into a confusion, it tends to be kind of at a much, you know, it's a confusion that's part of something that you're trying to do that's much more complicated than the stuff they were doing 10 years ago.
Yeah, and you've got this mass adoption of e-commerce, for example, which is, you know, back in the day was, oh, my God, how are we going to ever make money on the web because we can't take money?
Right.
You know, and that's become widely adopted. I'm curious, we've got a question from one of our listeners about which Jacob Nielsen book it was that you read, and I'm wondering if was it Usability Inspection Methods or?
No, it was Usability Engineering, actually.
Ah, okay.
Which it was like 91, I think,
1993, September 23rd, 1993.
Okay. And I remember quite clearly we were on we were down on Martha's Vineyard for a week, which we used to do in the summer. And I remember
that sounds quite posh.
We used to go to this a bungalow that was on a pond, and it was quite lovely. But I remember being outside a store, sitting in a parking. Oh no, it's a library. My wife was in the library with my son, and I was sitting in the parking lot in the shade. And I had a copy of this book, and the pages were getting wet with yellow highlighter. You know, it's like the book was starting to get soggy.
I
specifically remember because he had chapters on basically how to do usability testing and everything, and so that was the one.
Yeah, I love his eye tracking web usability book. That's a fabulous one as well. But so that's a side note. But I want to ask you one more question about mobile that we didn't really sort of take head on, which is has the mobile web changed web design? Do you feel like? I mean, do you feel like the influence is going sort of for this country the other way, where we're seeing more sites that are influenced by mobile, or is it really just more of a, you know, computer to person game still?
Well, I mean, mobile has a whole different set of design problems and usability issues because you're trying to squeeze something into a tiny little space. So it basically means that you know you have to choose to do less, you know, because you can't have things that are like 10 levels deep. Things can't be broad because they're too small. And so you have to kind of pick and choose what functionality you're going to support. And then you have to have big enough click targets, so that kind of limits even more how much stuff you can have on a screen. So there are big usability trade-offs in terms of, you know, the positive trade-off is you have it anywhere you are, you know. But the negative trade-off is that you basically have to design it to fit in this tiny little pigeonhole. That's a different kind of design.
And it seems like, you know, the sort of the tablet revolution that we're kind of in the middle of, especially with so many Android tablets being available now. And, you know,
you're,
I had
you're
my
really
first...
hot. You're really hot on these Android tablets, aren't you?
I did do a Microsoft OEM project last year, and that was one thing that hadn't been considered. And so when they brought me in as global, I said, include this. We have to be public. What are you thinking? Because the countries are using them like crazy. I mean, you look
right
at Singapore, hotbed of all kinds of, you know, people, English-speaking people, you know, that are using these things, and they're getting, you know, talking about early adoption, that's before the early adopters have access. So to me, that's fascinating. And, and you know, I think what you've got there is it added this layer of, so we had mobile, and
right,
we had the iPhone for a number of years. But what
right
it did is that it, you know, in other countries have showed us things that we could learn from. But, you know, you've got a bigger screen to work with. So, you
right
know, sort of the aspect ratio issues that you're talking about with this tiny screen and fitting things on, you've suddenly got options with the iPad that you never had before.
Right.
And so that makes, to me, an interesting little wrench kind of in the usability process, because it basically means you've got sort of three platforms that you've got to at least make considerations for if you're, you know, spending any kind of money on these things
right
these days. And it's just, you've got to be thinking about the smartest way to make the investment in the right people and the right team.
Yep.
You know, so for example, one of the things that I've noticed, and maybe you have a point of view on this, is, you know, companies that I work with that are in stealth or alpha, really getting into very complex discussions about hiring front-end engineers that specialize in UX versus UI.
Huh.
And, you know, I mean, to me, it's sort of like these days, user interface and, you know, needs to be built into sort of the fuller skill set that is UX. I mean, that's the way that I see it. But, you know, of course, that's not my area of expertise usually, but I'm just there to help the company figure out, you know, who the best person is. But,
right.
You know, hopefully... I think that speaks to something interesting that maybe I'll ask you about. So, you know, there are these definitions that come up, you know, the UX versus UI and usability. And how do you think about those things? Do you think they're just kind of these precious things that people hang on to, or are there truly skill sets that kind of should be defined that would help companies better figure out how they're going to improve their product for the end user?
Anytime somebody asks me anything that's vaguely like that question, I have this real strong feeling that I'm about to get myself in trouble.
Really?
It's almost like no matter what I say, I'll get myself in trouble if I say what I actually think.
You're going to the conferences, so you've got to face people. So that
I do. I try and stay home a lot. Honestly, I stay out of those arguments because I think they're completely unprofitable arguments. It's the same way I stayed out of a lot of political arguments, not because I don't have strong feelings about them, but because I think the arguments themselves are completely unprofitable. I can understand why people are having them. I can understand that it's helpful for people to define certain niches, that it's in terms of the marketplace, it can be important and useful, and that it's not just cynical, that people actually, you know, understand that they are better at some things than other people are. And so they want the clientele to understand that. So I, it's not that I treat it as cynical. I just think it's unprofitable. I think that, you know, any discussion that starts with large so-and-so versus small so-and-so, like large U usability and small U usability or, you know, IA or whatever. I kind of say, I think I'm going to go have lunch now. The fact is that I think that it's if you took a broad umbrella, and you know, the problem is user experience is probably the most reasonably stated broad umbrella term, you know. So mm-hmm. for people to come kind of late to the party and say, okay, well, there's this specialty user experience, and because we've co-opted that term, you know, we now sort of own this whole big bunch of turf. Now I'm getting myself in trouble. That one worries me. That one worries me because I think it's all user experience. You know, who's saying that when Lou Rosenfeld wrote Information Architecture for the World Wide Web, that he wasn't doing user experience work? You know, and when I wrote my book 10 years ago, this wasn't a user experience book. So but on the other hand, I think there's a specialty for people who, rather than that they specialize in usability or specialize in UI design, or they specialize in information architecture, or they specialize in, you know, search analytics, mm-hmm. whatever, that there's a reasonable specialty in user experience, which is something that takes a slightly more strategic view of things and encompasses not just the interface, but the whole context of, you know, is there a store? Is there an online experience? Is there, you know, what is it that what is the entire user experience? So that also makes sense to me as a specialty. It's just the arguments never
I mean, I've got myself in real trouble.
The arguments just never make sense to me.
Don't get yourself in trouble. So we'll switch from that. And I've got one more thing before I want to ask you a little bit more about the book writing process.
And I want to pimp my workshops, too, before we're finished.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. We'll definitely pimp your workshops. You have a great little site that I found, sensible.com, right?
Yeah, sensible.com, right.
I love it, love it. But,
which is actually, there's going to be a brand new sensible.com.
You got to keep your little drawings there.
96. Yeah, it has more little drawings actually.
I love it.
96 hours from now, whenever that is, I'm sure it'll be there. Along with a blog and a discussion board for people who are doing their own usability testing.
Oh, that's fabulous!
It's turning into a whole empire.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Well, we had Scott Kelby on earlier in the week, and he's definitely got the empire going in a great way. So I think that more you can get your experience out there and helping people learn and train and teach each other, that's fabulous. So
we'll definitely
keep an eye on that and make sure that we link to it from my blog. One of the other things I wanted to just ask you about before we move on to the book piece, which is, so important to celebrating the Peach Pit 25th anniversary marker, is gamification. It seems as though, everybody's talking about gamification, and I'm just wondering if generally you feel like that move towards, incentivizing behaviors and that sort of thing has any implications on usability that you've seen that you like or don't like?
Well, I can I got a round of applause at South by Southwest in March. It was the first time I'd been to South by Southwest. It was the first time I presented. I got a round of applause for a slide that said that at no point in my talk other than this particular slide would there be a mention of gamification.
It got a
big round of applause. So gamification was right up there at South by Southwest with social networks and mobile as topics that people were prepared to get sick of. It's only because gamification's fine. I mean, all this stuff is fine. Gamification's fine. But it's gamification isn't penicillin. I mean, the problem is, I think usability testing is really powerful and effective and a great cheap way to improve things. So I look at everything and I think, it's like I have a hammer and I look at everything and it's a nail. And so my answer for everything is usability testing and everything else. And I think gamification people, sadly, are kind of in that mode where it's gamification has worked well for some things, and it's the kind of thing that appeals incredibly to a lot of people on the marketing side. I'm sure if you're at Procter & Gamble, gamification is like crack. But how many things is it a solution for? I don't think a whole lot, frankly. That's just my personal opinion, and it's not I don't work for a company, so it couldn't be their opinion. Oh.
Well, that's fine, and I think personally, one of my stances is I love gamification in the sense that we've always factored in psychology somehow, right?
Right.
So I think it's more of just like it's the phrase for something that a lot of us roll our eyes and go, gosh, we took that into consideration. It's just been made easier by certain companies, some of whom I love, like Bunchball, one of the first people I had on the show. 3 years ago when it started, was one from Bunchball, and I love their product and the way they've been able to identify people, especially in discussion forums, who are just superstars, and give them incentives to continue to be useful, wonderful parts of the community. But I can imagine that there's a lot of people that probably don't want to be recognized for that.
Right.
That could work for a competing company. So I think there's implications either way. So let's move on to the book. I mentioned earlier I would ask you if you had anything to do with the title, Don't Make Me Think. So you've got to answer that question for me.
Yeah. I made it up. Yeah. That was what I had to do with it. I actually had been using it for years when I did presentations for clients mostly. And it really, I did state it exactly that way. I said, if you're only going to have one thing to keep in mind, then that's what it should be.
And then it carried on.
Yeah.
Right? So you've got, tell us about your other books.
Right. Well, the other book was that was actually I'll tell you very briefly the story about the first book title, which was I had a different title which I was really fond of, and fortunately somebody else had used it unbeknownst to me a couple of years before, and so I had to go looking for another title, which was fortunate because it was nowhere near as good as Don't Make Me Think. And then when it came time to do the second book, I had to come up with a title, and that was kind of daunting. Because one, it's hard to come up with a really good title, and two, it had to compete with Don't Make Me Think as a title, so it was bound to kind of suffer by comparison. So it took a long time. The second one's called Rocket Surgery Made Easy.
Yeah, I had to have you say it, not me, because it is such a cool name, and I just wanted to know how you would say it
right.
More than anything. Is that geeky or what? But
right.
And that's just, I think that's a fantastic name because, you know.
Well, my corporate motto had been, it's not rocket surgery, because I always tell people, you know, it's like I have this cushy job. My job is not that hard. It's mostly common sense. And I think most people can, with a little effort, can learn to do, you know, a reasonable job, a percentage of what I do on their own. That's what I strongly believe. I can do it a lot better than they can because I've been doing it for, you know, 20 years. So hopefully I can do it a lot better. I've seen a lot more, whatever. But I do think that it's something that you know, anybody can learn to do a fair amount, and that everybody should learn to do some of it. I think that there should be, if you're going through a design curriculum these days, I think there should be a one semester course in usability. And that's all it takes is a one semester course. But I think there should be, because basically usability is watching people try and use the thing that you're building, you know.
Yeah,
and
very real life.
It just produces so much value for so little effort, and I think designs are, you know, or it's you know, I mean, you go through a design curriculum and you learn to do you know, and make use of design critique, right? You
right.
Know? One of the things you learn, in the same way, I think if you're doing, especially if you're doing anything interactive design, then you should learn how to do usability stuff.
So let's talk about relationship with Peach Pit. So, you know, where were you in your life where you realized you had potential to become an expert on usability and then, you know, maybe come to the conclusion or somebody approached you with the idea that this needs a book?
That story. Okay. The problem is all my versions of these stories are unvarnished. The unvarnished story about the book is I didn't set out to write a book. I was Roger Black, who Roger Black's tagline is he's designed more newspapers than you've read. And I had done some work I had worked for a client who Roger Black was like the lead design person for, and then I did some work with him he had a web design company, one of the first ones called Interactive Bureau. And he decided that he had actually done a book back in like 94 on web design. And so around 98, 99, he decided that his company would do a series of books. And they connected up with, I think it was Macmillan at the time, who then got purchased by New Writers, who then got purchased by Peach Pit, whatever, Pearson. And they set up a deal where Roger and his design firm would find authors and get them to write books and format books and basically deliver whole packages to Macmillan, and they'd do a series of books on web design. And at one point, he said to me, well, we should have a book on usability. You want to write a book on usability? And I said, okay. And the reason why I said okay was because I wanted to increase my consulting rates. I had a very happy consultancy, and I never wanted for work. I got passed from person to person and was doing fine, but I didn't have the nerve to charge, like, really high rates. And I figured, well, I can't do more work because I don't have more hours in a day, so I've got to increase my rates if I want to make more money. If I had a book, it was like The Wizard of Oz, you know, if I had a certificate or medal or something, then I could my consulting rates. And so I wrote the book. It took a year, It was miserable. I almost bankrupted us. My poor wife survived it. Because I'm a terribly slow writer. I'm a really agonized and slow writer. And then it came out, and then it gradually caught on. I did it to double my consulting rates, and I found out after the fact, by talking to some people after the fact, that I actually could have doubled my consulting rates before I wrote the book anyway. But the nice part is that I actually never expected to make more back from the book than the advance I got, so I could take the time to write it, and I have made more back from the advance.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, like 300,000 copies.
That's fabulous. So that explains kind of how you got involved in the Peach Pit publishing community. So
yes.
I guess, you know, as Peach Pit developed from the time that it was acquired and new writers and Peach Pit became their own brands,
right.
What does the Peach Pit brand mean to you? Because, I mean, it's very much about teaching people, you know.
They've been very good to me. I've just been very happy. The people who I've dealt with all along have just been, you know, I like look forward to seeing them because they're nice, interesting people.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear.
Oh yeah. No, on the other hand, it's like everybody. The problem is the relationship between writers and their publishers are inherently antagonistic because writers don't really want to write books because it's too freaking hard, and publishers have to get them to write books. So like everybody, I know a lot of people from a lot of different publishers now who are in that business, and so it's very nice to be able to say that you really like your publisher because it's not always that true in the business. So they're very nice, very smart. Karen Whitehouse, in particular, you know, 12 years ago now, was the person who saw my first book through, and she went to bat for it. I mean, she got me ridiculous. It was like Orson Welles. I had complete director's cut of the book. Really, I got to make all the design decisions and got to, you know, if there was an argument about whether something was being done right or not, I got to say the way that I wanted to do it. And
bless Karen Whitehouse from Peach Pit.
Exactly.
That's fabulous.
It's been a very nice experience. I feel like, you know, I mean, I have a ton of their books sitting around because I like them, so it's a nice thing to be able to be one of their authors. They cover a lot of ground.
So this is your opportunity to pimp your venture as well. But
I owe it to not just myself but to my wife and son, but to Lou Rosenfeld because we've done these together for years. Lou Rosenfeld has his own publishing company, but he's friends with the people from Peach Pit. But we've been doing workshops together for like 7 years now. So we've got fall workshops coming up in D.C., Seattle, and London. And it's Lou does a day and I do a day. And then we've got one guest with us each time, which this time they're Indy Young's doing mental models, and Steve Portigal is going to talk about interviewing skills for UX people, and Anders Ramsey on designing with Agile. So like UX methods, if you're stuck in an Agile team, how to do UX for them, or if you're not in a UX team, how to kind of learn from the Agile principles, how to do better, faster UX methods. So we're sort of all looking forward to that.
Fabulous. Well, send me links to all of that so people can get
okay.
a hold of that on my website. I want to thank you.
And if they go to sensible.com, they'll find all of it and more.
And I want to thank you so much.
It will, however, have usability problems. I always tell people my site has usability problems. It's like... Can't help it.
So wait for the 96 hours, and hopefully they'll have discussion forums to complain to you about those usability issues.
Exactly. Or they can comment on the blog post. It's probably even better. They can.
Fabulous. Steve, I want to thank you so much as we close our discussion, and the 25th celebration of the Peach Pit Press continues tomorrow with Christopher Breen, and I thank you for being part of this. You're a hero of mine.
Cool. I'm always happy to do something for them. They're really good people. So.
Fabulous. Well, I'll let you get on with your day. I want to thank all of our listeners for hanging in with us. If you want to learn more about the history of Peach Pit Press, go to its website at peachpit.com. And we want to thank you for listening to the program. Please feel free to embed, download, or otherwise share the show. Have a great day.
All right. Nice talking. Bye.
Bye-bye.